the influence of the Kabbalah on the halacha. And tonight, my job is very, very easy, because basically what we're going to do is to go through this article of Professor Katz in Hebrew, which I handed out to you. It'll be a little bit easier for me to simply sit here and read with you something and discuss the gist of Professor Katz's article. The main topic is those areas in which the Kabbalah and the Halacha have come into conflict. And they have come into conflict, says Professor Katz, in basically two types of issues. One is a conflict of authority in deciding halachic issues. That is, classically, in halachic literature, pre-Kabbalah and post-Kabbalah, for those who have rejected any Kabbalistic influence whatsoever, like the Mashal or the Chatan Sofer, neither of whom can be classified as particularly liberal or non-conservative or even non-reactionary in the case of the Chatan Sofer, but they reject any influence whatsoever of the Kabbalah in deciding any halachic issue, because the halacha has its own mode of argumentation. Having its own mode of argumentation means that to some extent it's a rational system. It's not completely rational, because after all, it's meant to regulate not only relations between man and man, but also regulations between man and God. That is, most of the shilas that a rav gets today have very little to do with Hoshim Mishpat. They all have to do with mostly our Chayim nowadays. Yerideya is also more or less a highly centralized function. But nevertheless, the mode of reaching a decision is one of argumentation within a certain framework and then decision. And furthermore, the mode of reaching decision, as in any situation of rational discourse, entails to some extent a certain amount of compromise. Whether it's compromise between competing views, or whether it's compromise between the written form of the text and custom, or whether it's compromise between custom and the written form of the text on the one hand, and economic and other types of social pressures on the other, the person who adjudicates the halacha within the framework of a halachic discussion does so by long-established rules, like all rules that bend here and there to meet new needs. On the other hand, the Kabbalah, which regards all of the commandments as symbolic, and every single thing that you do has some effect in the divine realm, that leaves very little room to compromise. That either you do it right, or it's worthless. And therefore, inevitably, in the course of, say, 7 centuries from the beginning of the Kabbalah in the 12th century until the middle of the last century, for example, and now, of course, with the resurgence of the Kabbalah even today, we see conflicts between decisions which are based on the Kabbalah and decisions which are based on halach. The second mode of conflict between the Kabbalah and the halacha has to do with primacy as a subject. Should a person devote the majority of his time, or all of his time, to the study of Gemara, of the halacha, of with perhaps a minimal amount of time devoted to other topics? Or should one dispense with the study of the halacha, or at least relegate it to the bare minimum necessary to know how to just get by, and devote oneself to the true study of the divine realm, of the Kabbalah? In other words, the nigla should be replaced by a study of the nista, to use the technical language. Now, there's no doubt that a person who was probably, to no small extent, responsible for this belittling of the halacha is the Rambam, because he, after all, the study of the halacha, because he took the statement in the Gemara that davar katan is habayu sabayu v'rova, and interpreted it to mean that the study of the Talmud is unimportant in comparison to such things as the study of philosophy, of science and philosophy, and so on, and for which he was duly reprimanded by the later authorities such as the Ran. And of course what the Kabbalists did is just simply replace the primacy of the study of science and philosophy by the primacy of the study of the... So remember that Kabbalah uses mitzvot as symbols of events that are occurring in the divine realm, and we saw some of them last week, and we'll see more of that over and over again as we go on. And I may also want to remind you of the basic difference in point of view between the what I might call, in quotation marks, rational view of the halacha and the Kabbalistic view of the halacha. That is, for the rationalist, the ta'amei ha-mitzvot, God's commandments, are all man-directed. If the Torah tells you to do something, it's because it serves some educational purpose, or it serves some social purpose. That is, it's meant to either improve you personally, or to improve your relationship with your community, or to establish a good community. In other words, the classical, or perhaps not so classical, because perhaps the classical view was that one shouldn't engage in the study of Ta'amei HaMitzvot altogether. But if you're going to look at the Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reason for the mitzvot as formulated by the Rambam, for example, they are all directed towards man. Whereas the view of the Kabbalah is that the mitzvot are all directed towards God. By performing a mitzvah, the human is not improving himself, but he is remedying some possible defect in the divine realm. So by...
What about the rationalist view of relationship? By doing this, it's relationship to God.
Yes, but yes, the relationship is relationship to God, but the purpose of the mitzvah is to improve your relation to God. In other words, to make you more sensitive, to make you more aware, to rid you of false beliefs. Many of the mitzvot lo taseh, the Rambam explains, as being of given to eliminate idolatrous practices, for example. The elimination of idolatrous practices is something which is man-oriented. Man, you might be tempted into engaging in idolatry, and by not shaving your beard or by not eating milk and meat together, for example, that will prevent you from being trapped into idolatrous practices. So those are man-oriented in the sense that they're improving your spiritual being. Whereas if by putting on tefillin you're essentially restoring some balance between four different spheres in the Godhead, that's an entirely different explanation of why you're doing the mitzvah. Now, obviously, the Kabbalist's view of doing the mitzvah endows it with a far greater significance, and therefore, the chance of error is far more dangerous. Secondly, after all, if the Mekubal has this secret knowledge, then to some extent, his secret knowledge trumps any form of rational discussion. So to the extent that he becomes empowered by this secret knowledge, anything that he says which trumps classical halakhic discourse. Now let's just read the evolution of all of this in Professor Katz's article, and what we're going to do tonight, boring perhaps to those of you who have read it, but worthwhile to those of you who haven't, is work our way through Katz's article. So I will I'll start on I'll be following Katz's pagination, so we'll start on my page 8, which is Katz's page 11.
There, you know what?
Alright. So on the amount of time, I have that last paragraph on the bottom of page 11. In their essence, Professor Kant says, that is, on the issue of the foundational notions of the two sides, that is, the Kabbalah and the Halacha, the Kabbalah and the Halacha don't, apparently, should not need each other at all. The Halacha as a system of rules for the guidance of the individual and the community works according to principles and rules which have a legal, rational character. This rationality, of course, is not absolute and complete because the source of the authority of the Halacha derives from the belief of its irrational character explicitly. That is, that the generalities and the specifics of all of the Halacha were given to Israel at Sinai. That is divine revelation in its development. And this is not only a dogmatic issue. The Halacha differs from secular law which controls relations between people, in the sense that it also controls the relations between man and God in deciding various forms of worship. In deciding those types of religious prohibitions and so on. Things which by their very nature are of an irrational character. And a certain amount of this aspect falls on all aspects of the Halacha because it regards the divine will as the ultimate source of authority. This irrationality, that is, this divine character of the origin of the authority of the Halacha, also finds its place in the expressions and concepts and ideas of the Agada, which accompanies the Halacha in the Talmudic tradition. Thus, the Halacha, the Agada, accompanies various ethical and rational explanations and by giving a certain amount of irrational meaning and a mystical meaning and perhaps even a mythical meaning to various forms of worship and religious prohibitions. It's conceivable that in their origin, the rulings of the Halacha and their irrational aspect, a mystical aspect in the Agada, were indeed interwoven one with the other in a very complete fashion. So that it's conceivable that one should regard the ritual, the actual ritual expression of the Halacha as the actual ritual expression of this spirit that found its literary expression in the Agada. This was, for example, the claim of Yitzhak Ber as far as the sacrifices are concerned. However, in its later developments, and certainly after the time of the end of the Talmud, the Halacha appears like a closed system, which its modes of discourse and discussions to explain its principles and the structure of its decision-making, which is attached to it, are self-contained. The need of the Agada and afterwards of religious philosophy for the foundational notions of the Halacha in order to give spiritual explanations to mitzvot, to actual mitzvot, came into being without actually involving in any serious way halachic discussion and the decision-making process. Similarly, Kabbalah, when it arose, it took its place alongside the Agoda and religious philosophy and fulfilled a similar need to theirs. And, of course, it should, in principle, be prevented from influencing the intellectual evolution of the halacha itself. In other words, in theory, at least, there should be no influence between one and the other. However, the whole aspect of the study that we're going to be engaged in over the next few weeks is to see how, indeed, this type of influence came into being and what effect it actually had.
They mean like the Agoda, with regard to halakha, was parallel with the same idea with Kabbalah and Agoda.
What he is saying is this, that it may have been that at some early stage, before the time of the Gemara, before the time of the Mishnah, maybe even earlier, there was no clear-cut distinction between the Agoda and the halakha. That's a theoretical possibility. But as you well know, the Agoda plays essentially no role in deciding halakhic issues.
As a matter of fact, I think I remember learning in Masechet Matos, specifically one of the portions of the Tosfos, we cannot learn.
That's right. Many of the Rishonim explicitly say that you don't derive a halakhic ruling from the Agoda. But Professor Katz is saying it is conceivable that this notion that you don't derive a halakhic ruling from the Agoda is a late development, late relative to, say, the Second Temple period.
But without Agoda, you don't have Kabbalah either.
No. So let's understand. So what the question that Professor Katz is raising is this, that within the classical halakhic tradition, certainly, from the time of the close of the Talmud onward, there were two separate realms. There was the realm of the halacha and the realm of the agoda. And in principle, the agoda had no influence, or very minimal influence, on any particular halachic ruling. The agoda was there perhaps to give meaning, or to give some kind of a elucidation, or explanation, or make you feel more comfortable with a particular practice, make it more popular, and so on. But it never got involved in the actual decision-making process. Similarly, those medieval Jewish philosophers, the Rambam, for example, as the example par excellence, tried to use philosophy or their own particular views in order to explain the reasons for the mitzvah. But in the case of the Rambam, he may have involved his philosophical views to some extent in eliminating those mitzvot which he felt were based on superstition. Like, for example, you don't find in the Rambam any halacha whose origin in the Gemara has to do with the existence of demons or other forms of superstition. He managed somehow or other to strike them out of the book. But beyond that, his philosophical explanations of the halakha didn't have any influence on his decision-making process. So what Professor Katz is saying is that in principle, you might imagine, the same thing would hold as the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah was some form of explanation of the halakha, which theoretically might exist in its own right, but shouldn't necessarily have any influence on the decision-making process. But the whole point of the next few weeks of discussion is to show that that's not what happened. That indeed, the halacha and the halachic views tried to impose their will on various specific halachic making processes.
Kabbalah,
right. Okay, so he starts with the earliest text that we have, which is the Sefer HaBahir. The Sefer HaBahir is ostensibly presents itself as an ancient midrash. But in fact, it first appeared in Provence between 1150 and 1200. And perhaps from the language, the scholars of the subject seem to feel that it came under German influence, that it was influenced by German mystics to some extent. We really don't know. The Sfirot, which, may I remind you, in the Sefer Yetzirah meant numerals, just the numbers, the numerals 0 through 9, and the Sefer Yetzirah used these numerals to combine in the Arabic numeral system to form all numbers, and the Sefer Yetzirah was basically a book which was sort of a magical or scientific, as Professor Langemann says, book having to do with how you combine letters and numbers and so on. By the time the Sefer HaBahir appeared, the Sefirot had already acquired the meaning of divine attributes. That is, they are now the 10 spheres. Well, as we mentioned last time, this evolution occurred because of the fact that the theory of the active intellect amongst the Arabic version of the Greek philosophers had these various different spheres which represented the emanation from the prime mover down to the sublunar sphere. In the Kabbalah, the Sefirot of the Sefer Yetzirah became identified with spheres which themselves became identified with divine attributes within the divine realm, that is, within the Godhead, as opposed to being actual objects out there in space. So the Sefirot have become divine attributes, lights and powers, and each one of which fulfills a particular function in creation. Also, the Sefer Bahir introduces for the first time the notion of transmigration of souls. This is an idea which had been opposed by every Jewish philosopher up until that time. And let me remind you that the Tamei HaMitzvot are based on the theory that the fulfillment of a certain commandment signifies an activity of a particular sphera. The issue that Professor Katz tries to discuss is, why did the Sefer HaBahir select certain mitzvot for explanation, because there are only a limited number of them in the Sefer HaBahir, and not why did certain of the mitzvot seem worthy to the Sefer HaBahir of this kind of Kabbalistic and mystical interpretation and investment, and others not? So in the Sefer HaBahir, the phrase Torah Shebiktav corresponds not to the written text, but to the Sefirah of Tiferet, and the Torah Shebaal Peh corresponds to the Shekhinah, which is Malchut. According to Rabbinic Judaism, there's an absolute chasm between the human and the divine, despite the existence of revelation. After revelation, the Torah becomes a human endeavor, but according to Kabbalah, the Torah given to man is part of the Godhead as one of the divine attributes.
We'll see this.
Whatever that
means.
I don't know why you're just... So, let's go through the list of the mitzvot which the Sefer HaBahir actually deals with. Tzitzit.
Can I
ask you,
does it
number
them, like 6, 7, 13?
Yeah. But not in the Sefer HaBahir.
No, but how many
is
the number
of the Sefer HaBahir? I will give you the list of mitzvot which have given a Kabbalistic interpretation in the Sefer HaBahir. There's Tzitzit, Tfilin, Talmud Torah, Tchuma, Bechol, Shiluach HaKan, Korbanot, Nesiat Kapayim, the four minim of Etrog and Kulav, etc., Brit Milah, Shabbat, and the holidays Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret. Okay? No? For example. Okay, so let's read Katz on his page 13. In the Sefer HaBahir, the concepts of Torah Shebiktav and Torah Sheba'al Peh are removed from their simple meaning and are identified with divine attributes. Torah Shebiktav in the attribute of Tiferet, the Sefirah of Tiferet, Torah Sheba'al Peh with the Shekhinah. In this identification, we see a fundamental direction of the Kabbalah to overcome the absolute chasm between the world of man and God. This division was a given, a firm given according to Rabbinic Judaism. Even though one believed that God revealed himself to his creatures in the Torah Shebiktav and in the Torah Shebaalpeh. Even though there is a divine origin of the Torah and its use as a means to serve God, once the Torah had been given, it turned into a human activity. And as we saw in the first Shiur, Lo Bashamayim Hi, Divra Torah Kelashon Bnei Adam, etc. This is not the viewpoint of the Kabbalah. According to it, the Torah remains invested in man, but it is rooted in the very essence of God as an aspect of one of his attributes. The fulfillment of the Torah by man influences, therefore, on what is actually happening in the divine balance of powers, in the divine system. This is a very important change in viewpoint. From here, one can see an entirely new relationship, religious relationship to Torah, to its study and to its fulfillment. Chaye Olam Haba, which according to rabbinic tradition refers to reward and punishment by God to those who fulfill his wish or who don't fulfill his wish, now have to do with a direct consequence of the involvement of man by his means, by his actions, in the reciprocal activities between the various attributes of the Godhead. In other words, Torah, the Olam Haba means that by fulfilling a mitzvah, I'm changing the balance of power within the divine realm. A purely theurgic, or I would even say magic, activity. That invests, of course, every single mitzvah of what I do with a cosmic importance, because what I'm doing now is changing things in the divine realm. This is changing God's nature. It's much more than changing God's will. It's changing when there are certain... I mean, Ellen last week complained about what this has to do with monotheism. But let's understand what's happening here. In this, there is this entire structure built up of what the nature of God is, and there are various forces acting within the Godhead. And they're in constant tension with one another, and perhaps in a state of imbalance. And by your performing a mitzvah, by your putting on tefillin this morning, you have managed to help restore a certain amount of balance in God himself. So it's not just that you're fulfilling God's will, you're changing the very character of God. It's a drastic change of viewpoint.
You say God.
You can say Kaviyachol, or you can say, as Professor Katz sprinkles in the necessary Kaviyachols here within the sentences. I've eliminated them because they're just sort of.
I have to say that it's because of the will in your actions that you got to doing it.
But you see, you're stuck within a rabbinical viewpoint. You're stuck within the viewpoint that says that if I fulfill God's commandment, then in some sense I will be rewarded or the world will be better. But suppose that by fulfilling a particular commandment, you have altered the balance between the male and the female aspects of God. That you have altered the balance in favor of Chesed as opposed to Gvura, for example. That's a drastically different interpretation.
Or something like man is participating.
Yeah, you are participating in the cosmic order. That's right. Mishtateh in the Merkava. Right. Okay? So this is a drastically different view of the nature of fulfillment of the mitzvah. If I say, L'shem yuchud kutsha v'richu, meaning that I am performing this mitzvah in order to cause a unity between the male and female aspects of the Godhead, that's an entirely different view of a mitzvah than if I'm doing a mitzvah in order to fulfill God's wish. Yes?
Is the fulfillment of the mitzvah under the Kabbalist viewpoint, must it be conscious and intentional?
Oh, sure.
Have this effect and not accidental? That seems to be a consequence.
That's why we say these things before doing the mitzvah.
So it must be.
Yes. Okay.
We never do that.
Right. Well, I didn't either, but here we are. Okay. All right. So this unmediated involvement by man in the divine realm was certain to bring an exceeding, how does one translate that? Zealousness to the fulfillment of the mitzvot. And as is explicit in one of the statements of the new view, Im yishmeru zot hamidah ba'olam hazeh, the people fulfill this particular aspect in this world, and that is the Torah Shabbal. Per yizkula chaye olam mashu ha'tov haganuz l'tzadikim. Generally, we could say that this new viewpoint applies to all the Tayyag mitzvot, as in their generality and in their specifics. But, as we said, there are certain mitzvot whose details could express the Kabbalistic doctrines by their identification with aspects of the Godhead, symbolic aspects of symbolically, as we will now explain. These therefore achieve what one might call a special status amongst all the other mitzvot. And the question is, why did they actually achieve this status? And if gave them this special status, the Kabbalists who chose them for their mystical interpretations, weren't they really discriminating between one mitzvah and another, between one halacha and the other? We will try to answer this question in relation to the Sefer HaBahir. And for that reason, we should make a review of the mitzvot and the halachot, which did manage to achieve a Kabbalistic interpretation. Here they are, tzitzit, filin, we just read them before, tzitzit, filin, talmud Torah, Bechor, Shiluach HaKan, Korban, Nasiat Kapayim, Abba HaMinim Shabbat, Brit Milah, Shabbat, and the holidays of Atzeret and Sukkot.
I got a larger classification those that are listed.
Those are the ones that the Sefer HaBahir chose to give Kabbalistic interpretations.
Yeah, but that underneath it, there's a subset of the other belonging to the category.
No. He chose these. And what Professor Katz is trying to analyze, and he's going to give a historical analysis rather than an ideological analysis, is why the Sefer Bahir happened to pick these particular mitzvot.
He's not discounting necessarily all the other mitzvot.
Who's he?
The Sefer that you were talking about. They're not necessarily discounting. They're just saying these are the only ones that you can use to...
Professor Katz is trying to explain to us, and I hope that by the end of the evening we'll understand what he's trying to say. He's trying to explain historically how all of these different mitzvot achieved a Kabbalistic interpretation. And he's doing this by going through in the various stages in the development of the halacha, to the extent of the Kabbalah, to the extent that we have the texts. And I can summarize basically what he's saying, in that originally, the earliest text that we have, which is the Sefer HaBahir, which certainly was probably contemporary or maybe a generation or two after the invention of the Kabbalah as some doctrine of spheres and so on, it's not much older than that, chose a certain number of mitzvot. And the reason, as Professor Katz will explain, why these mitzvot were chosen rather than others was that each of these mitzvot seemed to have had a agada attached to it, which was lend itself to some symbolic interpretation. The striking example is tefillin. If the Haggadah said that God put on tefillin, well, that may offend the monotheist, strict monotheist, unless he gives that some kind of an allegorical interpretation. But the mystic can easily now say, well, when I put on tefillin, it's as if I'm helping God to put on his tefillin, whatever that means, and therefore altering the balance of powers within the Godhead. So therefore, the very fact that there existed within the classical Haggadah a list of mitzvot which did have Haggadot attached to them, which could lend themselves to a mystical interpretation, allowed the Sefer HaBahir to choose them. Now, the Sefer HaBahir didn't sit down and say, I'm going to choose these because of this, but this is Professor Katz's interpretation of why these particular mitzvot were selected rather than others.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. I mean, are all the others, according to the Sefer, to be excluded?
No, they're not excluded.
They just weren't discussed.
Remember, the Sefer HaBahir itself is an incomplete and a difficult document. It's not as if it's something which is not a simple, easy text. It's not something which can easily be read from beginning to end. It's sort of, we don't know that we have the full version, this, that, or the other thing. But to the extent that we have some reasonable version of it, certainly it's got precedence over others.
Are we saying essentially that the Kabbalists were opportunists? They read
right.
Both that they could use.
Well, opportunists in the following sense. And he says this better than I, and we'll read what he says. But basically what he says is that when the Kabbalah arose, it had to arise within the framework of the existing Jewish tradition. And therefore, it had to attach itself to those things which already had the potential of its in the existing literature, so that it wouldn't be regarded as completely deviant, even though the key ideas are so completely antithetical to the classical rabbinical Judaism. It had to be able to present itself in such a fashion that it could attach to the existence tradition. And in the subsequent generations, as the Kabbalists became more sure of themselves, the scope of their interpretation was enlarged beyond this starting point. So the three principal texts that Professor Katz is going to analyze, and we will analyze with him tonight, is the beginnings in the Sefer HaBahir, then followed four texts briefly by the son of the Raiva, who was a leading Kabbalist, then and by Ezra of Girona, and then finally the Ramban. And we will see in the progress of where the Kabbalistic interpretation managed to conquer more and more territory within the Halacha. And then next week in the Yetzer Hashem, we will take on the Zohar and see how it dealt with Halachic ruling.
So this L'shem Yichud is sort of taking this mitzvah and articulating a purpose to it.
Right.
Which was never done just through a bracha. There was no articulation of a purpose.
Well, we will discuss brachot also. But because that's one of the things that the Kabbalists seized on. Right.
But it's tying into some correspondence between man and God and man's fulfillment of a portion of God's so-called existence.
Right.
Through the mitzvah.
Through the mitzvah, according to the Kabbalists, but through the performance of the mitzvah, you're enhancing God.
Right.
You're having a direct positive or negative influence on what's happening within the divine realm. Right. Right. Yes.
Taking this logic of his and jumping of Professor Katz.
Yes.
And this sort of historical evolutionary approach that's so-called non-ideological. But when you take it 5 or 6 centuries ahead, you can see that the selectivity of the Sefer Bahir, could be argued, is already setting the stage for Sabbateanism.
Well, we'll come to the 17th century in due time. But at the moment, let's just see what... Let's read Professor Katz. So where am I now?
Top of page 4.
Okay. There's no equality as to the mentioning of these mitzvot in the Sefer HaBahir. There are those whose names are mentioned, but they are brought with an explanation which is entirely different. For example, the phrase "v'yikuli truma," whose original meaning was that you make a contribution, right? According to its explanation of the Sefer HaBahir, means raise me with your prayers. In other words, you are elevating God by praying rather than collecting a contribution for the Maimonides school, for example. All right. And the intent is, the meaning is that with the prayer, when it leaves the lip of the mouth of someone who has devoted himself to separate from this world, that is, Professor Katz leaves it open as to whether it means asceticism or ecstasy, aids, again I will eliminate the word kabayocha, aids God in the accomplishment of his inner, in the passages of his inner life. So in this particular context, the pasuk itself was removed from its original meaning. The notion of truma has disappeared entirely, and the pasuk is presented as if it's talking about the power of prayer. This drasha of the Bahir begins with a question. Yashar Rabbi Yochia sat and made a drasha. What does it mean, v'yikuli truma? And this is the standard opening of a drasha for psukim, even when they don't have any particular halakhic consequence. But this is only an opportunity to give a particular view rather than a question about the reason for a mitzvah. Similarly, as far as the law of Bechor is concerned, the question was asked, what does it mean when it says Kadesh li Bechor? V'chi ha'vi ha'kadosh baruch hu Bechor? So it's again completely misinterpreting the meaning of the passage. Instead of saying, make every firstborn holy unto me, it means, make me holy as if I am a firstborn. Right? That's the reinterpretation of the passage. It removes the meaning and it transforms it, having nothing to do with the mitzvah. And the answer in Kadesh Libuch, in Kadesh Libuch, Ela Sheini Bukadesh, Venikal Shem Yisrael, the Chdiv Beni Bukhari Yisrael, Kabiochal, Imam Haiti Bashat Shibur, Bahani the Ksiv Shlachet Beni the Abdunik Lo Yehuri. So it's referring to the name of Israel in God's name, that according to him, the Galut is not considered Bukhar, and Mitzvah Bukhar is completely forgotten. Similarly, as far as Shiluah Hakan, the question asks, what does it mean to say, send the mother away, and doesn't say send the father, and therefore this has something to do with which is certainly has to do with one of the halachot of the sending of the shiluach hakan, which according to classical halacha applies only to the mother and not to the female and not to the male, etc. So there's a question if this has anything to do rather than an excuse to connect the word aim, which is mentioned in the Torah, with its parallel, ki aim lebinatikla. According to our reading, by the way, it says ki im lebinatikla, but the Gemara already has the reading aim, that the Agada reads with a tserev al mukubalim, turned it into a symbol for the sphere of Bina. In other words, the word aim now has turned, because of this particular passage in Mishlei, which we don't even read that way, but the some sources did read it that way, your Targum Onkelos also reads it that way, is now being interpreted. The word Ein means the Sfira Bina, and the Shiluah HaKan has something to do with the Sfira of Bina, one of the aspects or of the Godhead. Okay. Later scholars, whose intention was to give reasons for the Tamei HaMitzvot according to the Kabbalah, found in these particular selections of the Sefer Bahir grounds for their explanations. It's doubtful whether they, by doing so, actually correctly identify the original intent of these drashot, but it's certain that the understanding of the mitzvot according to these drashot was only a theoretical interest, because these were mitzvot that weren't practiced on a daily basis. And their understanding according to the Kabbalah could not possibly have influenced the actual daily practice of the people. That, I mean, how many times has any of us actually sent the mother away while gathering the eggs from the nest, for example? And certainly the other mitzvot. Well, according to the Kabbalah, according to the Sefer HaBahir, this particular mitzvah had to do with the relationship of the Sfira Bina. Okay. Therefore, it's clear that the drive for these particular mitzvot can only be attached to the will to anchor the forms of this new Torah, that is the Kabbalah, in the traditional holy sources. And therefore, things which work even in a drasha.